call our Board of Regents committee meeting to order. And we're leading off the heavyweight today.
Radio and TV audit, so I will turn it over to Michael Bell and John Crowe.
Okay. Well, we do want to thank. I can go ahead and make a motion.
I'm sorry. I thought you asked me to.
I did.
Probably asking me to come to the table. I'm jumping ahead. Okay.
All right. So, first item is the acceptance of the auditor's report, financial statements for WKYU-TV and FM radio for the year ended 6/30/2008. I hear a motion. In a second, discussion. So, please.
Hello. I want to thank you guys for the help. We'll start with the radio's financial statements. We have them in front of you. On page 3, we have management's discussion analysis, which is just a high-level overview of the activities throughout the year. Prepared by Emily, and like I said, it's just a high-level overview of what went on throughout the year. Kind of summarizes the financial statements. Beginning on page 8, we have the statement of net position, which is Michael Bell with the balance sheet. It is consistent year over year. The only really changes we have this year is the adoption of GASB 75. Years past, we had the adoption of GASB 68, which was the invention that was placed on the financial statements. This year, we have GASB 75, which is the OPEB portion that you will see, which is the other post-employment benefit obligation. Strictly related to the insurance portion of the retirement. So as you see, it is fairly consistent. You will see that the net position liability did decrease as compared to prior year, which is attributable to the state having more funding this year, which then reduces the university's portion of that liability. The next page, on page 9, you will see revenue, expenses, and changes in the net position. There was a little bit of a spike in operating revenue. Expenses were fairly consistent. And then at the bottom, you will see the cumulative effect. What that is you have to show the effect of the earliest reporting period. So at 7/1/17, you have to show that adoption. So, lack of a better word, you have to not restate, but you have to true up your net position as if it would have been adopted at 7/1/17. The next page, you will see the statement of cash flows, which just shows the changes in cash year over year based on operations of the station. And then page 11 is notes to the financial statements, which is just the highlights of the financial statements. And they go, I hate to say, on and on and on. It provides more information than you probably want to know. But how big a highlight is going to be related to pension and the OPEB portion.
What was, if I could add again, that deferred inflows on the KTRS pension, that's a significant increase. It's slightly less than $600,000.
Yes, sir. So if you look at that as compared to the net pension, so the net pension increase is about $1 million. The deferred inflow also increased. So what that is the state contributed much more in 2018, which then in turn the university had to contribute less. There's also some other factors that take into consideration of that, which is your funding, so your kind of healthier funding, and then also the mortality rates and other factors that are taken into that. But if you net those two liabilities together, you see a slight decrease, which then in turn is where the state contributed more in 2018.
No way of figuring out how that would be for 2019, is there?
No, sir. And again, that is based on the state. The state of Kentucky gets an audit every year, and then we get those numbers passed on to the university. And then this is the station's portion of the university's liability.
Kind of a flood member.
Sir?
Kind of a flood member from the state.
Yes, sir.
And members of the committee, any questions? Jason? Good.
Yes, sir.
Anybody else? Board.
Okay.
So we go to the TV financial statements.
Please.
So it's much of the same presentation. Beginning on page 3, we have management discussion analysis, which is just a high-level overview of what is comprised of the financial statements. Those go through page 7. Again, that is just a high-level overview of what you'll see on the next 3 pages. On page 8, we had a statement of net position, fairly consistent year over year. As you also see, radio really only new piece is the OPEB portion, which again was adopted in 2018. You will see that there's a portion of debt paid off in 2018, so there is no longer any debt associated with the station. So again, much like radio, the only new portion will be the OPEB. And like you said, the net pension did decrease, but if you look at the deferred outflow and net those together, you'll have a slight decrease, which again is attributable to the state contributing more in the current year. On page 9, we have the statement of revenues. Revenues were fairly consistent with a very slight decrease of around less than $1,000. As such, expenses flowed in the same correlation, so revenues were consistent for the most part, expenses were consistent. And then at the bottom, you'll see again where we have that cumulative effect of the adoption of GASB 75. On page 10, we have the statement of cash flows, which highlight the changes in cash based on operations of the entity. And then page 11, we have the notes of financial statements, which will highlight what goes on in the previous 3 pages of the financial statements.
And just for clarification purposes, just to confirm, both of these opinions are they're not qualified.
My opinions, yes, sir.
Member of the committee, anybody else? Any questions or comments? All right, I got a motion on the floor and seconded. All in favor of approval of the motion with respect to FB 1, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion unanimous. Thank you very much.
Thank you so
much.
Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Director. And just number 2 is, hold on 1 second, get on the paperwork here. Action item number 2 is the approval of the 2019-20 tuition and mandatory student fee. It appears on page 2 and 3 of what was provided to you. So at this time, I will entertain a motion for approval of that.
Mr. Chair, may I ask a point of order? May I do the complexity of the subject and then let's have a discussion first so we can have Ms. Mead's comments on how the calculation formula works.
If I have any objection to that.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I couldn't hear.
Oh, I'm sorry. He's asking for a discussion before a motion. I guess you're asking for a point of order. Jason, do you, David, anybody get any objection to that?
I agree with that.
So we're going to go ahead, if you can go ahead and make a presentation.
Yes, sir.
Before a motion's made.
Before I get started, I have been under the weather. I'm not sure. I sound loud in my head, and I'm not sure how I'm carrying, if you can hear me. And I'm a little cloudy. I'm making a recovery, but I'll do my best today. I think I'll be a little light on the enthusiasm.
Okay. Well, I'm sorry.
I'm going to give you my best effort, okay?
Yeah, that's dedication.
So what we have is a recommendation for tuition and mandatory student fees. And, yes, there is a lot of complexity to this recommendation. Some of the items are, in fact, in your agenda item. The most important variable is the Council on Post-Secondary Education set a maximum 6% increase over 2 years. We chose to take the 4% for 18-19, leaving a 2% increase for 19-20. The actual calculation from the CPE is $5,401, so we are $1 less than the maximum. The reason we're $1 less is we like a number that's divisible by 12 to get a even $450 per credit hour. The military rate is set at the resident rate. The non-resident rate, what you'll see on several of these items, non-resident and international and graduate, a lot of these rates are being frozen for 1 year to allow us to develop different marketing strategies and determine over the next 6 months to a year what should be our pricing strategy, how do we use our scholarships effectively, and it's in our best interest right now to just go ahead and freeze these rates, especially since we continue to struggle with some enrollment declines. So the other variable I think is important for you to know is a lot of these rates are allowed to be set by us without any parameters from the CPE because they're market-driven. So we allow academic affairs, the provost, the deans, to determine what they think are appropriate rates, especially in the practice-based doctoral programs. So you'll see some frozen rates there as well. So these recommendations that we're bringing forward include the academic community weighing in on appropriate pricing for the next academic year. The dual credit rate, I have a rate in your schedule. I hope I don't have to come back and change it. We're a little early. The dual credit rate is driven by two components. One, the scholarship component, what we have, and the KCTCS tuition rate. So there's a maximum that we're allowed to charge for tuition and to allow students to continue to receive the dual credit scholarship. There are some adjustments recommended, again, related to on-demand, an increase in the graduate on-demand to align it with the distance learning rate. In most instances, the on-demand courses are online and look much like our distance learning courses already. In case you've not heard before, the big difference between the on-demand is the amount of time a student has to complete a course. While you might start it in the spring, you have, I believe, a maximum of 9 months to actually complete a course. So if you're in a distance learning course, you're bound by the same 15-week semester, and the on-demand allows you a more work-friendly, easier schedule for actually completing that course. Now, I know I've gone through a lot of calculations pretty quickly. I see that I didn't mention one. And this, again, was a pricing strategy that we had already developed out of the admissions office. We have the tuition incentive program, call it TIP. That rate, we have been moving toward an easier explanation that the incentive rate is only one half of the non-resident rate. So right now what we had is we've been anywhere from 27% of the resident rate or 33% of the resident rate, and it's much easier for admissions officers to say, what a great deal if you're an incentive county where you get to enroll at one half of the out-of-state rate. All right, I covered a lot. What questions do you have?
Well, I've got one question, and you and I briefly discussed this before, and that is the actual increase is a little bit, appears less than the percentage, but there are certain fees that are taken out.
That's correct.
Could you explain how you calculate, literally to get, and I'll start at the top, from 5301 to 5400. I realize it's rounding.
We have two fees, the student center fee and for the DSU bonds, and the parking structure fee for precinct. Those are considered special use fees by the CPE and are not subject to the 2% increase. They are frozen. So what they do in giving us a maximum parameter is they take the 18-19 tuition, they back out that $100 of the two fees, they calculate the 2%, then they add $100 back in. So you actually do not get 2% on your total tuition and fees. But the net effect of all this is about like 1.9%. So we're reasonably close to what you expected as a 2%.
Okay, but 5301 for fiscal 18 has the fees you just mentioned in it.
Correct.
And then you have to back that.
You have to back out the $100 before you calculate the increase. So the CPE's recommended total cap is 5401.
And for clarification, back in January, you gave us some information and you made that calculation and said the number was, after you backed out the $100, was 5405. Then it was 5301 minus the $100, gave us a baseline of 5201 times the 1.02 came to 5305. And then you added back the 100, which gave us a max of 5,405. And today, you're indicating it's 5,401.
We're bound by the CPE calculation. I don't see that they've made an error. All I can say is that I did.
No, go ahead.
So the rounding down of a dollar, I know it sounds like a dollar, but what would you calculate the fiscal impact on an annual basis of that dollar difference?
40,000-50,000
per year or per semester?
Per year. I don't think it's much. And again, the reason we do that is the billing system. Sometimes I don't understand technology, but they'll tell me that. Dealing with a rate per credit hour that's not rounded to the nearest dollar and then with refunds and everything else, it's much easier to tell the student that it's $4.50 a credit hour rather than $4.50 and 12 cents.
How many students are impacted by that rounding? How many students percentage-wise are 12 hours and above and pay the flat tuition amount and there are no rounding issues to be considered?
It also gets into the refund policy. So it's not necessarily just that if you're full-time or part-time and the rate per credit hour, but it gets into what happens if you drop a course and you get a partial refund.
I know it.
I understand that you're wanting to say that we should take advantage of maximum increase. I'm just recommending that we go ahead and stay with the 450, allowing no more technical adjustments to our billing system.
I understand, and I guess what I would throw out for consideration by our committee at this point in the board of interest, $40,000 or $50,000 doesn't sound like a lot. But it's a forever adjustment, number one. Number two, that would allow us potentially to have another counselor on staff to address student needs. It would allow us, for example, to give more need scholarships, maybe 3 or 4 a year, 5 potentially. So I just wanted your reaction to the potential that even though it's, quote, that number, would that not give us some funds for some of those things that we seem to be presented with opportunities?
While it's a valid point as to the number of items of importance that could be funded, the problem is that, as you'll see in one of my other agenda items, when you're $3 million short, you know, it's chances are you're in the current year with work record projected to be 3 million short tuition. It's not going to solve that problem. And it's more likely going to be applied to the shortfall than it is to a program allocation.
The last question is that I'm still not getting a divisible number by the figure you use,
5,400 divided by 12. I hope 5,400 divided by 12 is 450, but if somebody else has got, they're always calculating the amount. I don't have one.
5,301 wasn't 5,400.
Is it Jason?
5,400 is.
Last year was not.
Yeah. And I promised the bursar I wouldn't do that again, but technology will fix it. They managed to get through this year.
I'm finished. Sorry.
Jason. David. Anybody else have any comments, questions, class?
Two questions there. I didn't quite understand what you said about the incentive fund. This is 50% of what?
We're trying to move the incentive rate to be equal to 50% of the non-resident rate.
50% of the non-resident rate.
I think this one, if I recall my calculation, we may be at about 52% right now with the recommended.
What I do not understand, suppose you wanted to move in this direction, why are we increasing it?
True. Part of that is the psychology of what you're approving. And should some students still continue paying an increase rather than no increase? So we have chosen over the last few years to soften their increase and allow the gap to be closed more gradually.
Well, but that widens the gap. That widens the gap.
Right now, we've got a slight increase, but because we went back and decided to freeze the non-resident. Correct. Valid point.
The other question I have is if you wanted to give us a ballpark estimate of the totality of money which would be generated by that amount. I mean, that's most likely the total money we'll have to have for the next budget cycle. So how much would that be?
I haven't calculated that number yet because we're factoring in the decline in enrollment that has occurred this year.
Okay, so you couldn't even give us a ballpark estimate?
I think that's a little dangerous to put a number out there. If I wagered an educated guess, the next thing I know, someone's going to say, well, you told me we'd have this much money to spend. And I don't think we'll have a lot more on the budget at your next committee meeting. Obviously, a 2% increase is not going to generate.
Okay. I mean, so if I were going to do that, right, if we roughly have $190 million tuition fee revenue, right, and you would take 2%, that's $3.8 million. But that's less overall than a 2% increase here because some fees do not, some things do not increase. So, you know, from my perspective, something like $3 million wouldn't be too far off.
That doesn't take into account, pardon me, tuition discounting, all the other pieces as well. So I would agree with Ann. I don't think we want to make speculative projections without having real numbers.
All right. Fair enough. Steve?
Yeah. On top of this, these numbers here, have we had a committee or have you reviewed at all of the external student fees other than these four that are listed right here from the individual colleges? Because that's where I have heard a lot of concern from students as they get tacked on thousands of fees.
Yeah, my, my understanding, that was done by
That is on Provost Baumann's radar. That's one of her plans to go move forward. She's evaluating a proposal right now that would govern the evaluation of all fees.
Perfect. And is that going to get updated at one of our meetings soon?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
I'll put that on the list.
Thank you. Anybody else have any questions? I need a motion since we started out with the presentation.
I'd like to move that the committee adopt the permissible fee structure with CPE. An adjustment, as I understand it, to undergraduate rates would be $1 more, $54.01.
Everybody understand the motion?
Yeah.
Second. Reading 4 seconds, the motion. Let's have further discussion on this at all. Not in the committee, we'll discuss. Motion on the floor is to increase it to maximum CPE to whatever that calculation is, which is estimated to be approximately $1. Correct?
That's his understanding. That's correct.
All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Can I interject something before you guys vote?
Okay.
So the question I have, and if you were going to do this, and it's a fractional amount, is there any expense related to that?
I believe that I wouldn't have to venture a guess on that one.
Okay. So my point is that if you estimate this is whatever. $40,000-$50,000 in addition, if there's an expense from it, which is caused by having to deal with fractional numbers, you would have to subtract that. So this change might not yield the amount you anticipate.
My question today would be, we had a fractional amount last year. So we had it last year, and we have it this year. It would seem to me that the expense is already baked in, it's consistent. It's going to be no different than what we did last year. And hopefully, this number will lead to $40,000 or $50,000 of additional revenue that the university can apply to the student's benefits. Is that correct, Ian, that we had a fraction last year?
We did, so IT can actually accommodate it. It's just not as easy. And with the billing specialists that deal with the public, saying what your bill is. And again, it hits the part-time, is the ones that will come up with a rather odd-looking bill when they sign up for a course or two. But yeah, technology will handle it.
Any other comments or questions? Well, there is a motion on the floor, unless you care to change it anyway. There's a motion on the floor. It's been seconded. So all in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Okay. So FD2, let's go to FD3, which is approval of personnel actions. And I believe that they are contained in your handouts F1 through whatever, and beginning with S1 as well. I will entertain a motion for approval of the personnel actions. Moved by Regent McKinney. Here a second.
Second.
And any discussion on this?
I don't believe there's anything to add other than to point out that the reason that these are so lengthy is that it includes the mid-year increase that went into effect January 1.
Any questions, Van, on this topic from the committee? David? Ready?
Question.
Jason? Anybody else have any questions or comments? Hearing none, then I will ask to vote on the motion. All in favor of FB, or action on FB number 3, please by my saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion carries. FD4,
4 is approval of the 2018-19 operating budget revisions, which appears on pages 5 and 8 of your handout. I will ask for entertaining a motion for approval of the operating budget revisions.
So moved.
Motion and a second. And any comments on this? Yes.
So this is a lengthy agenda item that includes two components. One is what we call carry forward campus understands balances brought forward from the previous year and requesting board approval for expenditure. And then a second component, which is how much of adjustments we want to propose to the budget that you approved for July 1. The total carry forward generated was a little over $27 million. And then when we apply the carry forward policy, divisions that have approved reserves, based on the policy, reserves are intended for large emergencies, large capital projects, eventual equipment purchases, reserves, shipping and receiving trucks. Reserves are not operating reserves that you expect to draw down on a regular basis. So what we have as your second line in your agenda item indicates that we had approximately $1.4 million added to those approved reserves. The budget we brought you for July included using S for expenditure authority for $3,665,000 in carry forward. The three items are listed: infrastructure repair fund, which is money that goes into facilities for capital renewal, IT upgrade for only $250,000. And then we indicated we wanted to use $3 million of carry forward, planned carry forward, to balance the budget. We did not ask for division carry forward. We knew that we were going to have another austere budget and did not estimate what that carry forward would be by division. So we budgeted $3,665,000 and knew that we would bring the final numbers back to the board for approval rather than estimating it through the budget process. When we determined what we needed for balancing the budget, we also indicated that we wanted to capture a little over $5 million in vacant positions through attrition to balance the budget. After the year started, we determined that it would be easier to not pull money out of positions as they became vacant to fill the $5 million hole, and it would be easier to allocate carry forward as a one allocation to balance the budget. So right now, even though we have a plan of capturing vacant positions, we made a decision that we would capture vacant positions effective July 1, allowing the balances from the staff turnover to accrue to departments right now for their benefit. So a lot of variables were happening, and it was not, we thought it was probably better to just wait and see what we needed for a variety of reasons, including using approximately $2.1 million for the anticipated shortfall in tuition this year. When you, what we had anticipated to do and what is reflected in the allocations to the divisions is we were planning on giving approximately one-third of a division's carry forward back to them for expenditure authority. However, the carry forward policy has a lot of exceptions where 100% of balances are returned to the division. For example, doctoral programs, facilities administrative cost recovery on grants and contracts, 100% of the revenue dependent programs That has been a point of contention. Is being returned to those departments. Now, while we are in some regard late in making this decision on how to allocate carry forward, it's important to know that the university does not operate on a cash basis. So divisions have already known for since probably November what balances are going to be returned to them, and could proceed with those expenses knowing that the carry forward would be approved more than likely by this board in March and allocated back to the divisions. So what you have is request expenditure allocations, carry forward return to divisions, $1.4 million. Programs exempt from the policy and balances are being returned, $13.4 million. Then carry forward to allocate to offset the vacant positions we aren't capturing between now and June 30th, $5.2 million. Carry forward to offset the projected tuition shortfall that accrues centrally only, $2.1 million. So the total is $22,126,672 as to what is being asked for carry forward allocation. There are, like I said, there's several parts to this. Do we want to stop on carry forward before I go to the next part of this recommendation?
There's additional $5 million of carry forward. Is it just going into reserves?
The additional $5 million?
Well, it says that the $27 million was generated in 22.
Okay, what I did is I started with the 27 and I worked my way down. So this accounts for all of the 27.
No,
you started with 27.
The 22 does not include the 30.
You started with 27 and I subtract the $1,370,000.
I thought the subtotal included all. 13 seconds.
No, I highlighted the 22,126 is that which the board needed to approve for expenditure authority. So the 22 million will actually be allocated to the budget. Do I have everyone with me? Okay, the next part is, as I indicated, that if you establish a reserve, we come back to the board for your approval to allocate from those reserves. It shows the seriousness of why we established those reserves. So the allocation from those reserves is $143,000. And I'm looking to see. And now $100,000 of it is related to IT. And $43,000 is for Postal Service Reserve to replace mailing machines. So the $100,000 from the Educational TV Reserve is for the Diddle Arena sound system and technology upgrade.
Can I make a point of clarification on that? I had spoken to this in your office, and there was I was reporting that out. It is not related to sound system or IT. IT is in place. It is to provide an equipment link between the academic complex and the sports facilities for a better student experience. That's just a mistake in the writing, and we had submitted materials that indicated the proper allocation for that. It somehow translated itself into sound system and technology after that. So I just wanted to clarify that for the board, that we're using existing fixed asset reserves. We are not asking for an additional allocation, and we will not be asking for an additional allocation for capital reasons or capital expenses. We're going to use, as Ann has pointed out, the reason we have reserves are to use them in this instance. It's really to provide a better student experience.
That's a great, it's a great opportunity for our students to be able to essentially produce games from the academic complex instead of having to be physically on site in what is an older control room in Diddle Arena. It's essentially a second truck, but in the academic complex wherever it is, wherever it is. So,
so that's the fourth item then.
That's the $100,000.
I apologize for the
no,
error.
It's
Thank you.
It's okay. I just wanted to clarify that because sound system has a whole
different meaning. I think it got lost in the translation, but thank you for clarifying. The third part of the recommendation has to do with changes in budgeted revenue. And you'll see those items listed on page 7. Consistent with the budget model, this allows revenue generated by departments to be returned to those departments. The largest change, however, is the performance funding loss from the state. When we built the budget, we had an estimate of what our performance funding allocation would be. We did not know until later exactly what the calculation would be, so we're adjusting it now. On the expenditure side, we had held some money in contingency, so there's no impact to any department by actually reducing this revenue stream in the budget.
What in that calculation caused the decrease? Was it this money be allocated or
no,
something?
No, it was a performance variable. The performance funding model for the state is as much about how do you improve compared to your peers. You can improve, but if you don't improve as much as everyone else, but we did have some adjustments in downward in some of our variables. I don't know if there's been a report to the board on this. So there's no impact to a department by reducing this. The funds were being held in contingency till we knew the final calculation. Any questions on allocating revenue?
I assume you agreed with the reduction in the performance bonus allocation.
Yes. All the calculations are validated by institutional research in terms of everything from graduation to how do our first-time generation students perform well with their students, all of the calculations.
Related to performance funding, there have been discussions among the university presidents in the past 6 months about taking a look at that funding model, how's it performing, and we agreed as a group, I think, almost consensus, that we wait and take a look at that, as the statute suggests, in 2020. There are issues with any formula. We're also trying to adjust things internally based upon a policy that's been created at the state level. You hate to mess around with that policy as institutions across the Commonwealth are trying to adjust a policy. So there are tweaks that I think we all, as presidents, would look at and see could be made, but I think we're going to let that ride for another year and see how it works out.
Are there any questions about the proposed revisions to the 2018-19 budget?
All right, please, David. Any questions?
No. Chris, sir.
Jason. Anybody else? Klaus.
What I would like to see is actually some sort of summary which tells us how the individual divisions have been affected by the budget cuts in terms of the actual money they spent. So from my perspective, when I look at this budget, this carried forward amount is quite large. In terms of the percentage of the overall budget, we really control it. It's almost approaching 10%. And so the question I have, does it have to be that large? And it makes it very difficult for me as an outsider to actually see what is the effect of the reductions on the individual divisions. So to give an example, if we look at the budget book, okay, and we look at academic affairs, which is the largest division. In the prior budget year, academic affairs had $27 million carried forward alone, and we sort of struck it out of the budget, right? And so when you look at the budget summary, it appears that academic affairs has taken a huge hit in the expenditures because what is reported is that is minus 27 million in terms of the carry forward. And now some of this is returned to academic affairs, and so it makes it difficult for anybody to actually see what is the effect of the reductions we have done on the actual divisions.
So one of the things that, I agree with you, one of the things that is puzzling to me about some of our budgeting is the size of the carry forward. And because when we talk about gaps in our budget, the reality is we have revenue. The question is around where is that allocated? And can we get closer to allocating that in advance instead of on the back end? And I agree with you. I think we're moving toward that. But, right, it's complex because you look at the budget, you think, look at the reduction, and then the back end you have something filled in, and the total budget at the end of the year winds up being not what it was at the start of the year.
Right.
And apples to, you almost look at apples to oranges, unless you're looking at complete end of year expenditures year over year.
Is it fair to say that the issue that you just addressed is the result of trying to convert from where we were in a budget model to what we have now proposed as a budget model, and that we're in that no person's land?
So I'm hopeful that as we use the new budget model as a tool to craft budgets, we'll be able to adjust some of that and have a little bit more prediction about how much carry forward will exist, and can we plan be more planful about that or allocate it sooner. The other is, from a philosophical perspective, carry forward is may not be the most efficient use of resources, meaning if you're waiting to see what you get and then spending it, or if you have money left over at the end of the year, is that where that money should be allocated, or should that be allocated actually someplace else? And we've not yet had those conversations, I think. But part of it has to do with who generates revenue and who gets to keep it. The other has to do with who's efficient in expenditures, and is there a reward to those units that are efficient in those expenditures? I think we'll be able to see more of that, particularly as that budget model gets another year added on, and watch over time our revenue shift, how expenditures shift. And hopefully we'll be able to do more of that.
Yeah, that's my point. Yeah, I agree.
The history of the carry forward policy was to address a use it or lose it mentality, and that you needed to be more thoughtful about what your long-term needs are. The budget model obviously addresses that in a more significant manner. There ought to be other mechanisms of determining budget management on a more timely basis that allows you to make those expenditures mid-year or third quarter rather than having them accrue to the net position of the university. On the flip side, I can tell you that accruing these balances strengthens our balance sheet and does look better with the rating agencies. So there's an argument either way, because once it shows up on the balance sheet, they're not coming back and saying, well, what is your expenditure policy and how are you going to use those balances? Once they're captured and show up on our balance sheet June 30th, we actually look healthier. So there's some financial complexities to it, but we will definitely make progress toward in the 1920 to try to do a better, closer estimate of carry forward to see. Now, the other thing I would add as I ramble, when you think about fiscal year 19 and what we went through last spring, we had some extraordinary circumstances. We had reductions in force. We were capturing vacant positions. We were trying to bring you a balanced budget. We made $18 million in cuts. So once you get financial stability, yes, some of these other things will fall in place. If you didn't need $9, $10 million of it, of carry forward to balance your budget, when we finally wean ourselves off of a carry forward allocation necessary just to make revenue equal expense, then you'll have more management ability to allocate carry forward and estimate it as well earlier. Any other questions?
Hearing no other questions, I'm sorry, did you have questions? No other questions, and I'll in favor of the motion 6579. Opposed? Motion carries unanimously. And we look forward to action item number 5, FD5, which is the approval of the 2018-19 second quarter statement of revenues and expenditures. And I'll entertain a motion.
Accept it.
Bridge and Ford, motion, second.
Second.
Second from Bridget.
This is the second quarter report through December 31st. For the most part, you understand operations like grants and contracts and auxiliaries are held responsible for managing expenses within their revenue. So that is no concern. What I have pointed out in the budgetary implication is actually beyond second quarter to update you on the student billings for spring and to inform you that centrally, as I've described in the other agenda item, centrally of fall and spring, we anticipate a 2% shortfall from the budget estimate, which is $3 million. So that does show up in the student billing, but not the in the tuition and fees line, but not, you won't see the full impact of it until the third quarter. There, I don't have any other items to point out.
Any questions from members of the committee?
What is the enrollment decline? Considering we raised tuition, what percentage is our enrollment decline to get to a 2% tuition?
So you have to disaggregate when you think about the enrollment decline in international students. And I've used this number several times. We had 28 years ago, 400 international students. We went up over a course of 4 years to 1,400 and have declined in the past 4 years to about 400 international students. This year, you're looking at a decline, both undergraduate and graduate students approaching 200 that pay full out-of-state rates. And you do the math on that, and it's a significant reduction. That, you think about a garden hose with a golf ball moving through it, it takes 4 years for a bubble to exit the hose of the golf ball. And so we actually have another year to go with that really high international enrollment to work its way out. And the hope is that as we begin rethinking that enrollment strategy, that we have some stability. It's not so jarring, the increase or the decrease, and that will start replacing some of the ones that fall from the front end. But that's probably a year away. Internally, the cohort of high school students graduating is declining in Kentucky, so the competition is fierce. There's a great Herald story that showed that we are in very good company with just about every other institution in the state at declining enrollment. And so the main driver in terms of revenue, though, is an international student population that is challenged not just in Kentucky but nationally, particularly at institutions that are not high-intensity research universities. That's us.
As you saw in the news, we were pleased by some improved retention numbers from fall to spring. So some people think that this is contradictory, that you're celebrating improved retention, but you're telling me you're $3 million short. I'll tell you that we would have been more than $3 million short had we not made those efforts to have enhanced retention. And as you get them from their first semester to their second, you have a much better chance of them persisting and moving towards a degree. So that's another bubble, but it's a positive bubble that we ought to start seeing some financial impact.
Positive. So this is where disaggregating those data is really, really important. Looking at those, what we have to do is look over time, the growth in enrollment, but disaggregating by freshman, sophomore, junior, senior year, disaggregating by student type, and thinking about the different sub-segments of that marketplace. To actually turn enrollment and have enrollment growth, it means you need to have people not falling off at a high rate off the back end. And that means that as that freshman class grows a little bit but retains, over time, your revenue catches up. And so this is it's turning a battleship. It's not going to be like a ski boat.
Ready? Thank you. Klaus.
I looked at the same sheet of last year just to have a comparison, and so I see that our tuition revenue, you know, estimate was $3.5 million lower than last year despite a 4% raise, and we're falling short of that. The other thing I noticed was that the actual second quarter year to date was $5 million higher than last year, and I just was wondering why that would be. Can you give any explanation for that?
No. Again, it could be just timing as to what happened as of second quarter that will even out with all these variances. What would be in the second quarter versus third? No easy explanation and no real complex organization. But other than central tuition, I don't see us having any issues with this budget, and we've already addressed how we're going to handle that.
Any other comments or questions? Hearing none, I'll vote on the motion. All in favor, say aye. All opposed, like sign. Motion passes. And thank you, and I'm not here for it.
I made it.
You made it. Thank you very much. Wait, you don't want to come out?
No, I feel like I need a life.
I know. She's
sitting over here. Yeah, I just had a little one get over the flu, so I just don't. I don't know. But
move over to the center. Right?
Yeah. Okay. I think it'd be okay.
Still
love you. Yeah. I just have two things to really talk about today, and they're really brief. They're both related to some NCAA compliance and guidance that we deal with annually. The first one is the NCAA ticket sales work that we do, and that's part of the agreed upon procedure that our external auditors do. So we can do a portion of that. And they take our work papers and our results and incorporate that into their larger report. So that's one of the projects we completed. The other one also NCAA related to the guidance that we have to go by for the football ticket sales or paid attendance, I should say. Based on the football division that we're in, we have to have at least 15,000 in paid attendance over a two-year period. And so we completed that work. We do the reconciliation and provide our results. And the previous season, I think we were under 15,000 in the paid attendance on average for the home games. And for this year, we were over the 15,000, so we still are in compliance. We were able to give that information to athletics, and they can use that to report to the NCAA. So those are the two projects, and you can see on your agenda item there's a list of things that are in different stages of the audit process. And we're working through some bigger projects as well, and those will come as we get those completed. The other thing that I want to talk about is the annual risk assessment. I think last time I mentioned that we wanted to move up when we actually start the risk assessment. So we've started conducting that this current quarter. And we typically do it in April and May, but that seems to be a little chaotic because people are kind of busy with end of semester, busy with going on vacation because it's that time of year. So we wanted to move that up, and we sent out the risk assessment packet to the President's Cabinet and gave them some notification and instructions on how to do that. And that it's something that they're used to. I think they've gotten this packet at least once or twice over the couple of years. So we're hoping that we start getting those results back in so that we can start building the risk profile and also start conducting those face-to-face meetings as well. But as part of that, I think you all know that you participate in the risk assessment as well, the Finance and Budget Committee members do. And so I have a hard copy of a very complicated one-pager that I need you to take and fill out best you can. We can send this electronically as well. Sorry. Okay. Thank you. So I think one thing I want to mention, too, about the risk assessment for this year, it's a really good time to start thinking about this, where we're changing budget models, we're implementing a strategic plan. And so the things that you might want to think about, you know, within higher ed, the industry itself, but also with WKU, what risks are potentially impacting the university. But we're doing a lot of different things with the new budget model and a strategic plan. So we've set these goals. And how do we get to those goals? Well, in between, we're making decisions. We're having to do different tasks with those things. What potentially could go wrong? What potentially could go right? And it's basically, to me, it's an awareness tool so that we're aware of all the risks that could potentially pop up with all these decisions that we're making as a university. So keep that in mind when you fill that out. If you can get that back to me before the end of the month, that would be great. And also, the President's Cabinet members have an earlier deadline for that, for those that are in the room.
Can I ask one favor, though? I know it's easy for me, I'll speak for the others. Could you send that electronically?
I will, yes. I just wanted you to go ahead and get a hard copy, too.
But if you could send it to the committee members, that would.
Yes.
Also, that would tickle their
yes. Member. I will do that.
The President's Cabinet members in the room and the President, what's the deadline for?
I think I said it is February 12th. And after that,
it's Tuesday.
Yeah, they got it way before you guys did. So, but then we'll set up those face-to-face meetings too and talk through those. The other thing that I've been talking a lot about probably for, I don't know, a year is the quality assessment review that our department will go through. And we are in discussions with someone that's external from here that will come in and basically tell us what we need to improve on. And it's something that's required by the standards that we go by as certified internal auditors. And so this person that I'm talking to, she's local. She's done QARs in the past. She's an internal auditor herself. She's currently very heavily involved with the Institute of Internal Auditors Nashville chapter. She's their president-elect, I believe. So we're in discussions about timing when our calendars can get together so that she can come and do the work. And then I'm not sure how long all of that takes as far as the field work that's involved with that process and then putting together the report and the findings. But I will tell you, this is something that we've been talking about for a long time and preparing for. We will do it every 5 years, and it's a way for us to get constructive criticism, hopefully. So that we can grow and improve what we do every day for the university. So, and if you have any questions about either one, the risk assessment or the QAR, let me know.
Great.
Mr. Chair, can I ask if all the board members could get the risk assessment? The additional members of the Board of Regents could also get the risk assessment.
To participate in that? Per the charter, it says Finance and Budget Committee, but I mean, we can do that.
I don't necessarily have an objection. I mean, Jason, would you help?
Everybody saw it.
Put everybody on a deadline.
Okay. Will do.
Can you send it to all of them, please?
I will do.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes?
I'm sorry. Anybody else can? Thank you, Jane.
Okay, thank you.
And that's my very short presentation.
Very good. Let's take a 10-minute break, and we'll come back.
to academic.
All right, we will reconvene, and we'll do that with our Academic Affairs Committee and Regent McKinney.
We only have one action item today, PA1, approval of sabbatical leave requests, of which there are several by college. Does anybody have any discussion on that?
I just want to say repeatedly, said some similar thing last year, that for a faculty member a sabbatical is truly valued and appreciated policy to have. And quite often the benefits of a sabbatical are only seen years afterwards. So I'll give you an example. I've had a sabbatical 2 years ago, and some of the work I have started during that time is now actually appearing as an article. So there's a huge delay effect of somebody having a sabbatical until the benefit comes in. It may take 2 or 3 years after this. So I'm strongly in favor of us supporting the sabbatical.
Any other discussion? Do I hear a motion to approve?
So moved.
Second. All right. All in favor say
aye. Aye.
All right. Motion passes. So then we have a presentation on the Kate from Maryland.
Thank you. And, beautiful, thank you. Good morning.
Good morning,
better than fast, but not bad. My name is Meryl Price. I work in the Provost's Office. I'm here to Dr. Dalton today, who couldn't join you. So what I'm going to do is give you a brief, I hope, overview of what's happening with the Kate review process. Okay, great. And then we'll have time for questions at the end, but if you want to interrupt me with questions in the middle, you're free to go ahead and I can move back and forth through the slide at will. So, just as a reminder, not too many months ago, you all approved the WKU strategic plan, and among the priorities in the strategic plan was the following: that WKU will engage deans and department chairs in a comprehensive academic program review to ensure WKU has an appropriate mix of study options and deploys scarce resources. And I think we've gone a little better than that, because we've not only engaged deans and department chairs, we've also engaged faculty very heavily in the process, and I'll talk about that as we go along. So, I wanted to give you an update on what our priorities are in putting this process into place and how we have tried to maintain those priorities thus far. So first of all, we wanted it to be comprehensive. The C in CAPE is the Comprehensive Academic Program Evaluation. And of course, we do review programs. I'm not going to read all these slides to you. We do review programs, but we've never done all programs all at the same time before. So this is a new process for us, and it's a very labor-heavy process. One of the things that we've done is discover how many programs we actually have, and it turns out we have 382, which seems like a lot. So, secondly, expeditious. You approved the strategic plan back in August. We hope to have the recommendations reaching you by your May 10th meeting. That's 9 months. That's a long time in business. But in academia, that is practically breakneck speed. Where we currently are in the process is that the individual programs have put together their self-studies using the data generated by IR and writing their own narratives. Those self-studies have gone to college-level committees. The deans have made their recommendations. Those dean recommendations and the self-studies have gone to the CAPE committee, which is a committee made up of faculty and staff members. And for the next week or two, the CAPE committee is going to be reviewing those self-studies and coming up with their own evaluations and recommendations. And we wanted it to be transparent. It's important that people know what we're doing and when we're doing it and why we're doing things in the way that we're doing them. So, among the things that we've done is make sure that we meet regularly with colleges, with the Senate, that we have a website that lays out everything that we're doing, and also that at each recommendation level, whether program recommendation level, dean recommendation level, hate committee recommendation level or beyond, that the faculty in those individual programs who are most affected by this are informed of what's going on. Now, that hasn't happened quite as successfully as we hoped, in that the dean recommendations came in last Friday. Some of the deans were really expeditious in conveying their recommendations to their faculty. Other deans decided to take an approach where they talk to department heads and have department heads talk to their faculty. In those cases, the process has slowed down a little. So while some faculty know their recommendations at the dean level, some currently do not. We're hoping to remedy that as soon as we can. And Chas, thank you for letting us know that that was happening. Data informed is the next point. And I made the note that we don't mean data driven, right? Because it's really important that the data doesn't govern what we're doing, that we use the data as a guide. So we had an awful lot of data generated by IR. We sorted through that data to find what would be most useful. We sent that data out to the faculty. The program faculty were encouraged to look at their data and to interpret their data, and then to write narratives that framed that data in an appropriate way, so that people outside of their disciplines who would be looking at their self-studies and assessing their programs will be able to understand what's going on. So our rule is, data will guide, not govern. Faculty involved. This is not the sort of thing that you can do from the top down. So among the things that we've done to get faculty involved in this process is that when we were putting together the rubrics and the self-studies worksheets and the scoring sheets at multiple levels, we had feedback from different department heads and also rank and file faculty. We allowed each dean to establish a college committee of their own choosing. Many deans chose college committees that had heavy faculty involvement. And then finally, at the CAPE committee level, we have 15 out of 18 members of that committee who are faculty. Those were largely nominated by Faculty Senate. We include the Faculty Senate Chair, the Chair of the University Curriculum Committee, and the Chair of Graduate Council. The other three members are staff members from admissions, from international, and from advising. So we have a level of committee that doesn't involve academic affairs in any way except as facilitation. Community and workforce relevance. One of our reasons for doing this was to make sure that the degree programs that we're offering will fit students for their futures, whether those futures involve graduate school as the next level or whether they're going directly into the workforce. So we had a panel of community leaders, and there they are, come talk to the members of the CAPE committee about the kind of qualities that they're looking for in new employees. What would they like students graduating from WKU to have in terms of skills, in terms of expertise, in terms of specific credentials. This is actually a really useful day, and I think we'll be working to build some partnerships with these folks who've had a lot to say, and some of it was quite eye-opening. Student serving. Haven't mentioned students yet, but of course, we owe students a great deal, and one of the things that we owe them is, in a university that has over a century of tradition, that we're not offering them centuries-old programs, right? We need 21st century programs to help students going forth into 21st century futures. Many of the jobs that our students will get haven't even been invented yet. So we need to be upfront, we need to be proactive, we need to be finding students the credentials and offering them those credentials that are going to suit them. And then finally, protection of tenure and tenure-eligible positions. We have absolutely no intention of affecting anybody's tenure status. And I think that is crucial in making these steps forward and getting faculty on board and in making this a shared governance decision. So there are four possible recommendations that a program could make for itself, and that deans could make for a program, and that the CAPE committee will be able to make for a program. The first is maintain. We don't have specific numbers, so we don't say, oh, we expect X number to be maintained, Y to be suspend, but maintain is the category that says these programs are doing just fine. All right, maybe they have had to draw down a little because they've been part of last year's RIP. Maybe they've lost some faculty over the years, but these are robust and healthy programs, and they need to be maintained. And we think that most of our programs, more than 50% of our programs, will likely fall into this category. The second category is suspend. And that is the second category only because of my informal survey of the recommendations that the programs themselves have put forward in the suspend seem to be the second largest group. And the primary reason for that at this level is that we have a number of programs that were moribund, programs that haven't had enrollment for years, programs that have very little in terms of student interest and activity. So those were the no-brainers. It's going to get a little more challenging as we go on, and we think that deans and the CAPE committee and beyond may be making recommendations to suspend programs that are a little more active. And one of our concerns, of course, is how we can help out students in that situation. Then there's transform, which is the most interesting category as far as I'm concerned. And we're not looking for tweaking a program around the edges. There's a curricular process already in place where faculty can change their programs, add new courses, have new recommendations, change their prerequisites, change their admission standards, those kinds of things. We're not talking about that. We're talking about really systemic change. So ways to change your program in a fundamental way so that it better reflects what the students need. And then finally, grow, enhance, which is the category that we would like to be bigger, but resource-wise, we think this is going to be the smallest category. These are the programs where we have students knocking down the doors to get in. We can't fit students in our classes because we have more demand than we can actually supply. So there will be some programs that fall into this category, but likely not a great many. And then this is the last slide for today. What we hope to gain. Again, I'm not going to read it at you, but there are a number of priorities that we're looking at here. We want to streamline a curriculum and make sure that the programs that we're offering, we are really offering. We're committed to them. They're not half-hearted programs that no one has done for years, but we're still pushing them onto students. We're looking for more efficient use of full-time faculty. We're looking for more student experiences with full-time as opposed to part-time faculty. We're looking for efficiency in course scheduling so that the classes we offer are fuller and offer a more rounded experience for students. And then finally, that last category, the ability to invest in growing programs. We've been dealing with austerity for a while. We've been cutting back. We've been handing over our carry forward. We've had our photocopying budgets cut. People have gone to part-time. We're fed up of making these little austere changes in our lifestyles, and we would like to be able to invest in the programs that really need investment. So, that's it. Happy to engage in any questions.
Can you talk about the next steps in the process and what that timeline will remind everyone?
Yes, absolutely. Next steps in the process is that before the end of the month, the CAPE committee should be done with its recommendations. By then, we should know which programs have suspend at some level of recommendation, and those programs will be allowed to, if they wish, to put together a case for why perhaps they should be in the transform category rather than in the suspend category. The next level of approval is the provost level, and then it will go to the president's cabinet, and then finally to the regents meeting, which will be at the May regents meeting, where this group will approve, will accept and approve the ultimate recommendations. Yes?
How do these, how to phrase this question? As you look at the recommendations as they're going to start materializing, as you start to think about it, you've got the classifications you just showed a few moments ago. How will that affect, or I guess it would be a part of the budget process as well? I mean, that part of this.
So long
it has an effect on it, I guess is what I'm it will. Saying.
Longer term. And so again, when you pull a policy lever at a university, because they're both loosely coupled systems and because the time horizon is so long, this is more about making sure we're focusing on where we have opportunity and places where opportunity may have either pass by or outlived their usefulness. We turn a critical eye on ourselves. So the budget implications would be, because remember, we're following AAUP, American Association of University Professors guidelines. Those faculty who are tenured and in process of pursuing tenure will continue to do that. Their allocation of instruction might shift, but they'll be there. So you will remember also that faculty who have part-time or term appointments, we've agreed and will continue those through at least spring of 20. So what this is a gradual shift that won't have immediate budgetary implications, but it will in these ways. So there are programs that will teach out, and then in 3 or 4 years, we will stop admitting to those programs. 3 to 4 years, the last students will graduate, and those will go away. More importantly, we'll shift resources to those programs where there is limited capacity and excess demand, and that has a direct relationship to additional tuition revenue. And so that's the place you hope to see a budgetary shift. The other is it forces a conversation and intentionality, particularly around at the dean level, around what's our program mix. You know, you can have a lost leader if it's important to the college, but you can't have all lost leaders because that's a recipe for instability. So the answer is long term it will. Short term, this is much more an academic and a focusing process, I hope.
The question I have is, how many students are affected? So I've seen the lists of these dean recommendations for 2 colleges, and there are some programs on there which definitely have majors in them. Not a lot, but they have majors in them. And so once we make this public that this is what we're going to do, I think we ought to be prudently estimate what the effect of such a thing might be on our fall enrollment. Okay, and we do know that lots of students who come here are undeclared, but some of them come to do a particular thing. And if that's no longer available, I believe that will have relatively short-term budgetary implications. Before it start off, they will be negative. In the long run, they will be positive, but in the short term, I think it will be negative.
You've seen more than I've seen.
Yeah, I'd just like to stress for a moment that academic affairs, because this is a faculty-driven process at this level, at the level of the CAPE committee, we haven't seen the dean recommendations. Academic affairs has not gone through those recommendations. I've seen them only because I've been putting them into various folders for the CAPE committee to read. So I don't have a list of those, and I can't say which programs are in which category. And everything at this point is provisional. So recommendations could change as we go ahead. So one of the reasons that we haven't issued a master list is because we don't want to muddy the waters. We want the process to play out and then figure out from there where we are. But yes, I think at the point where we have some definitive idea of which programs we're talking about, we ought to be able to figure out how many students that immediately affects, and also what fraction of those come here for those programs.
If I may follow up on that, I think it's crucial that we do with this process, as we did with the budget process last year, to allow these groups to work in a way that allows them to have difficult and challenging conversations and to do their work in a way that is somewhat protected. And we know we'll evolve over time. So if you reflect back on last spring, the last thing we wanted to do was say, this is a reduction we might make because that's unfair to the folks who were involved in that reduction. And so the same thing is true here. We want to make sure that when that information is finalized or moves toward finality is when you start talking about the specific categories. As much as I appreciate the transparency around the conversation, I think it is unfair to have individuals in programs that where a decision has not been made to feel like in some way they're being put at risk when that not has not yet, that none of those decisions have been made. And so I just want us to be intentional about that and understand why.
I think everybody would be interested in knowing what is the mood of the faculty, since it is faculty driven, it's going to affect them greatly. What can you give us any insight?
I'm not sure academic affairs is the right body to ask about that. That might go better to Regent Finn.
Yeah. I believe the question is, it depends on who you ask, right? I mean, if you ask somebody whose program just has been put on that watch list, of course, the mood of those people, understandably, is a very personal thing affecting their workplace environment. You know, overall, I believe, I hope at least, that the majority of faculty understand that such a process is probably overdue and is probably healthy. But feelings will be very mixed, no question about it.
The other thing that comes to mind as we look at this more efficient use of faculty and space and everything, in our Center for Innovative Teaching and Learning, I think would speak to some of this. So are they being involved up front here with some of this? We were actually hoping to be able to take a tour today, but they've had a change in leadership, and that's going to be pushed back probably till March. But
they haven't been at this point, but that's not a bad idea. As you said, the change of leadership there has complicated things. But certainly we would like to make sure that the pedagogical element of this doesn't get lost while we focus on resources.
I think they could be a big asset. Process moves on.
Dr. Price, thanks for everything today. Two points. Similar to what you may have alluded to Regent Ernst, the communication to the faculty related to their own department heads and deans. At this point, and I'm applauding this process, I think it's going very smoothly, until we get down to maybe the dean level. I am aware of a list that was shared with me from one college, but I'm also aware of faculty from another college whose department heads, as late as yesterday, told them that by order of the provost, they aren't allowed to share information with the faculty members. So I'm not saying that the provost has done that. I'm quite sure that she hasn't. But what I would like to see is a redirect from provost office that maybe reiterates the way that the deans, department heads, should communicate to faculty. Because while there is a lot of sensitive information that doesn't need to be shared, we want to make sure that the communication process is held to the same standard across campus. Because when, say, I don't want to name the colleges and give anything away, but say one publishes a list, sends it around in email, and it gets shared in perpetuity to almost everyone. And another one says, you can't do this or you can't do that. That's an inconsistent level of communication from the dean level down. Now, that's not faulting anyone. It's just that maybe they have interpreted information in a different way. So I would reiterate, maybe that's not maybe that communication needs to go out again, or that method needs to go out again. And the second part of this is, there may be some confusion with faculty related to the correlation between the reduction in minor programs versus major programs. So there may be some uncertainty that has come up related to how a reduction in a minor program constitutes a cost savings. So there may be additional communication that needs to go out related to that. These are only suggestions from a staff member. Point that out.
Yeah.
But these are, you know, things that have come to me and been brought to my attention.
Yeah, they're good ones, and some of those are on our radar, and I'm working on this.
For faculty that are going to have programs suspended or changed, and they're going to be affected by this, they're going to be retained. Is there going to be some formal process around communicating and transitioning what their new role is going to be?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And as the president has pointed out, we are obliged to teach out these programs. So changes are not going to happen immediately. But yes, absolutely. Sometimes faculty and people in the community conflate a program with a department. If just because a program might be suspended, whether at the minor or certificate or bachelor's or graduate level, doesn't necessarily mean that the department itself might be going anywhere. You don't need to have any or all of those programs within a department. So it's perfectly possible to have departments that don't offer one or more of those levels and still function as an active department.
I think the other... So we have work to do on this, but what's most exciting for me as a leader is that this gives us an opportunity to have a conversation around what might we do differently that is more attractive to students. So I know that the fear creates and self-interest create panic, and that's okay. But the reality is what this is going to allow us to do is think differently about how we're offering what we're offering and how we're deploying the scarce resources of our faculty. The excitement is around those courses or those programs that should be transformed. So how are we offering things in the future that we've not thought about yet? And how do we do it in such a way that we have different organizational arrangements that works within our new budget model? So, for example, I see wonderful opportunities with humanities degrees with a plus. So humanities plus computer science. Those folks in the market are incredibly sought after. Or how do we stop having degree programs equate to being in a department within a college? How do you break outside of those silos and create trans-institutional partnerships across colleges that is both good for revenue but also creates really interesting work? And so you think about the relationship between, this is across department, between engineering and science and biology and engineering. So you're doing microbiological engineering. Well, that's fascinating, right? Now, you have to have the right arrangement of faculty there, but that means both of those programs win. You can think about the same thing in other places. So, for example, leadership. Well, leadership cuts across at least three of our colleges. You have the College of Education, you have the Potter College, you have a business school, you probably would pull from the sciences. We have to push ourselves to reevaluate and rethink how we're creating degree programs. And that's the exciting part of this. And it gets lost frequently in the bureaucratic process and people being self-interested. And I just want to make sure that as we come to a conclusion of this part, that there is a real upside to doing this. And I don't want you to get focused in the hard stuff, because the exciting, fun, and interesting stuff comes later and as we go.
Just for information, what might not be clear to some of you is what the teaching load of a faculty member actually consists of. So if I take my department, this is a service department, because there are lots of other programs which actually use mathematics. And so in terms of the credit hours the math department generates, I would estimate that maybe 10 to 15% are actually the major. Okay? The other 85% are for engineers, chemists, computer scientists, or gen ed math requirements, which may be nursing, or you just name it. Okay? And so even that means that even if you were going to cut out the math major, okay, there would be a huge number of credit hours remaining which this department would be teaching. Okay? So it's not like that fall. I mean, there are some departments which are different, but there are many departments where when you cut the major, that doesn't mean that they suddenly have nothing to teach. Okay? So it depends on what department that actually is.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you, Mayor. That's all we have.
Thank you. We have Student Affairs Committee, and Richard Henson is here with us today.
Thank you, Dr. Chairman Dale. I think today we've got Chris Jensen with us. He's going to do a presentation on retention initiatives.
Thank you, Regent Henson. Thank you, Board, for letting me present. What I'm covering today is student retention updates. This is nowhere near an exhaustive list of all of the retention initiatives we are doing at WKU. Instead, this is just highlighting some of the significant changes we've made in the last couple of months. So first off, going back to the strategic plan in here, I talked right away about transforming and having centralized advising that would also include career, but also look at the student holistically, incorporating financial, mental, physical, and social wellness. We jumped on this quickly, so starting over the summer, we went from decentralized advising to centralized advising and moved our advisors out of the colleges into one unit, which is now the Academic Advising and Career Development Center, located on the second floor of Downing Student Union. With that group, we have 24 academic advisors that are carrying a advising to student ratio of about 250-1. That's well within what we want nationally and what data shows that we should be doing with our advisors to make sure that we're actually impacting them and making sure they're successful. Another change we did with that is we made sure students had the opportunity for walk-in advising every single day. Before, students would sometimes have to wait up to a month for an academic advising appointment, which was completely just unacceptable. Sometimes students had quick questions and we'd be telling them, wait to meet with an advisor. Now every day we have advisors available to students, both for academic and career advice. By bringing everyone together, we've been able to do a lot more outreach to our students. So during the semester, we have the beginning of the semester check-in, so all of our advisors are reaching out to all 250 of their advisees. Some of our advisors have a little more, just basically saying, hey, welcome back. Is there anything you need? We know the beginning of the semester is kind of hectic, just trying to help them out. Then we go to our fifth-week check-in, which I'll talk more about in a minute, which is a university-wide initiative. And then we're reaching out for priority registration. Our goal is to get as many students as possible registered during priority registration instead of dragging that process out. We used to have students that were registering all the way up until the first week, second week of classes, and we know that's not helpful for student success, nor does it really help us know exactly what our student body is going to look like until too late of a time. After the semester, we're doing degree audits to make sure students are on track, informing them about our repeat policy. Students are able to take up to 6 repeats during their college career, and we want to make sure they know that. It'll help boost their GPA because we factor out the first attempt. And then a new initiative we started, we're now following up with students when we see a 25% drop in their semester-to-semester GPA. The reason we did this initiative is we've seen students that would end up going for a long period of time where their GPA was dropping before they'd ever end up on academic probation and the university wasn't reaching out to them. So we wanted to be intervening earlier and trying to help them throughout that process. And then we're doing more student referrals by having it centralized. So our fifth-week check-in, as I said before, it's a university-wide process. This initiative, we ask all professors and instructors to report on 100, 200-level courses and the courses within our Colonnade program. This fall, we had a 92.17% faculty participation, which is the highest we've had since starting to include second-year students. So in fall of 2015, this project switched from we used to only do 100-level courses with freshmen, and now we expanded it to the first 2 years of a student's college career. Afterwards, we're doing follow-up with our advisors and throughout the university within enrollment and student experience. Other people are helping out and faculty. We logged over 3,000 interactions with students, talking to them about their performance and trying to help them out to make sure they're successful. This fall, we had a significant decrease in the number of failing grades reported, about 1,000 less. So that was exciting. And then due to the work of Ogden College, they have a retention task force. They've now asked for our 100 and 200 level courses, even if there's a junior or senior in there, can we report fifth week marks on them? So we'll be doing that, knowing that a student who is in their junior or senior year that is still taking 100 to 200 level courses may need a little more assistance, plus we're kind of wondering where they are in the process. So we are rolling that out, and that'll happen in just a week and a half when we start fifth week again. We're doing a lot of other initiatives. This last fall, we ended up rolling out microgrants and made the process more formal. The first one you'll see is the James Graham Brown Foundation. We used money from that and awarded 22 microgrants to underrepresented minority students. By doing this, we were helping them reduce their bills down below 1,000. That is a new threshold we have as a university. As long as a student owes less than $1,000, they can register for the next semester. Prior to this, it used to be if you owed any money, you were unable to register. So that was a huge impact and helped those students. Enrollment and student experience, they awarded 48 microgrants to seniors. We wanted to make sure that they were moving forward. Some of these individuals had exhausted all of their aid, and we didn't want them to stop out. We used to see students hitting just a barrier of, I've used all my financial aid, I have no other resources, and I may be a few credit hours short. And we ended up assisting them to get them down to that $1,000 barrier so they could get into their last semester and graduate from WKU. Another initiative that was very, very helpful is we did a large reduction in the number of holds on students' accounts. When we ended up pulling all the information, there was over 200 different holds that can go on a student account that significantly impacted our students and their ability to persist. Now we basically have it down to three areas. If a student owes more than $1,000, if they're a threat to themselves or others, trying to think of the other area.
Advising,
sorry, because that's required, and I should know that one. So thank you, Marilyn. Any other ones and you forget. So those are the three that are preventing registration for students. We tried to have the rest of the holds converted to transcript holds. What that does is it does prevent a student from receiving a transcript from the registrar's office if they were trying to transfer out. This also does have an impact when they graduate. If they've got to make sure they do everything with the university to get those holds removed so they can get their actual diploma awarded to them or sent in the mail and that final transcript if they need it. Academic probation and warning workshops. In years past, we used to not inform students very well. It just went on their account. You're on academic probation or warning. Specifically with the warning, we weren't telling them. We are now intervening with students earlier and holding workshops at the beginning of the semester saying, this is what your academic standing is, and here's resources we can provide to you as an institution. For academic probation, we do go a step further, and those students are enrolled in something called BEP. It's our Best Expectations program. It is set up like a course. It meets once a week for 12 weeks to work on study skills, note-taking skills, and self-defeating behavior to make sure that students are more successful moving forward. So what are the results of all of this? You've heard some of the things in the news. President Cavoni has shared it. We saw a 4% increase in first-time, first-year fall to spring retention compared to last year. 5.2% increase in first generation, 5% increase in low income, 7.8% increase in underrepresented minorities. Then I've heard a lot of people saying, well, all of these increases probably came because of us changing our admission standards. But then we go to these next two figures. We had an 8% increase in students who had two developmental courses or supplemental course needs, and a 5.5% increase on students who had three developmental or supplemental needs. So that is very significant. The three developmental or supplemental needs were typically our students that were housed on the South Campus in the past, and we have moved all of those students onto the Hill and are starting to see benefits. So moving forward, some other initiatives. We want to incorporate alumni. This is out of the strategic plan again into that professional and academic plan that we talked about. So actually, later this month, the Alumni Association has asked for volunteers to be doing phone calls, and they'll be reaching out to students where this is their first semester at WKU. We'll be doing it as a pilot, just to talk to them about, are they struggling, is there any support, and And we want students to know that our alumni care, we want to see you be successful, and they're here to help you. We know that with the Birch Institute and with ISEC, students are willing to open up to people that are connected to the university. So we've had a lot of students, it doesn't matter who you are, you say, I work with WKU, they're willing to just start telling you what's going on in their life and saying, I need assistance. So that'll be happening on February 20th. Additionally, we have the summer scholars starting. With the change in the CPE admissions requirements, we wanted to make sure that we created a program that students that may need a little additional assistance are going to be successful. So it is a five-week summer program where students will be taking 6 hours and living on campus to prepare them and make sure they have the skills needed to succeed at WKU. We do know that some of our students are not physically able to come to the Hill, so we have something called New Scholars that will be run out of DLO. It is an online version of this that will run during the fall semester. And then the last one is we are starting to move some of the financial pieces with our academic advisors. So we will be doing the satisfactory academic progress with our academic advisors so that the academic piece is integrated with the financial piece moving forward. So that is a brief overview of what is going on. I'm open to any questions.
Stephen, any questions?
Yeah, I've got a question. Over on centralized advising, there's one of the bullet points is student referrals. I assume that what you're doing there is you're allowing the students who have closer relationships with their peers. Is there any program within that to teach them, train them, what to recognize, what to see, to try to suggest to a fellow student you need to go over to advising?
Yes. So we are doing training with all of our advisors. We actually carve out every Friday morning. We're doing professional development with our advisors. So we have other departments coming in from around campus. We've had, we'll have career services, or I mean, counseling coming in to work with them to give them about warning signs. We're doing other things to make sure they see those. They are cross-trained to try to be able to assist the student as much as possible, but we do know there is a limitation to what they are trained in, and we want to do referrals across campus to assist the students.
But the student would make the referral on both sides, both to that student's fellow student, you should go to...
We're using professional...
And the other way around.
It's professional staff. So it's professional staff referring a student to another department.
Oh, okay. Understood it differently.
I'm aware of other things that can predict a student's success, and I think there's a company that specializes in that, Degree Analytics, I believe is her name. And any comments about that, or do you see companies like that being able to improve our numbers?
Sure. We have looked into many different softwares. We also have been working with IR, our IR department has created a predictive analytics model for us that we are using. We do know that one of the outside of high school GPA, the next greatest predictor is our fifth week assessment or fifth week check-in, and we're able to pretty much be able to determine based off of those marks if the student's going to persist in the next semester. But yes, we are looking at other companies. Is there anything you want to say about that, Brian?
No, we actually have talked to Degree Analytics and had some conversations, and we're looking internally to what other options we have.
Stephen, do you have any questions?
I didn't have any questions, just comments, but I just wanted to say, I was one of the people who was kind of against the comprehensive advising program in the beginning and resistant to it, but he had proven data that it's working. I just wanted to say good job, and I'm excited to see what comes of it.
Thank you.
Chris, is that 250-1 ratio every single 250 students to one advisor? I have 250 employees at the company, and my thought of having to deal with every one of them and try to advise them would probably. So as I'm looking at that number, all I'm thinking is, oh my word, that could be me. I mean, I was just trying to envision how this works. I was trying to get my head around it a little bit.
The good news is that it's down. We did have some advisors in the past having a ratio of over 500-1. And they were doing 15-minute appointments with students, only following up with them once a semester. So this is manageable and within what is recommended by NACADA, which is the National Association for Advisors.
And we find that effective?
Yes. And you have a lot of students that, the truth is, they don't need our assistance as much. They're very successful, they're self-driven, they know what's going on, they have a plan to be able to succeed at WKU. So that 250 is not the advisor having to meet with all 250 numerous times throughout the semester.
Bridget, if I could add, and I think this is one of the things we're trying to do is take a look at what the literature says works at helping students succeed. What the academic literature says, and also what other institutions have done across the country that's been successful, that has data to back it up. And so what we're trying to do is have a pilot and then go to scale. A pilot and then go to scale. All of which are things that have been successful other places, or the academic literature shows this works. And one of the things I want the community to understand, we're not just making this stuff up as we go along. Essentially, there are national best practices around persistent retention and graduation that we're implementing. And part of it is because of the James Graham Brown Foundation and their support. We're talking with them about deepening that and increasing our partnership with them and perhaps some other institutions nationally. But this is work that we're implementing, but much of it is work that's been proven elsewhere. And so I want to make sure that folks know that we have professionals doing this work who are trained in this area and are going outside and bringing the best of class here to WKU. It's important for folks to understand that. Klaus made the comment about Arizona State making sure in the paper, making sure that we're going outside and getting things around math and persistence and interventions. And that's exactly the kind of work that we're doing. And these folks are doing a tremendous, tremendous job. And Stephen, thank you for bringing that up. In face of a pretty withering internal critique about whether we should or shouldn't be doing this, we're going to continue having these results and demonstrating the success of this kind of intervention. And that's a place where nonsense walks, data talks. And we're going to use the data to kind of make our case with everyone.
Nice to see headlines like this.
Yes,
early retention data sparks hope for WKU's future.
Yes, David.
Just on a quick personal note, very quietly between semesters, my daughter transferred from another institution in another state to WKU. And all of her advising was done via email. All of her questions were answered. Everything that she brought up over a course of a couple of weeks was taken care of. She's had a wonderful experience. She wanted me to point that out if that came up discussion. But this is an example firsthand of how this worked. It worked from a distance and worked effectively. So she hasn't even met her advisor in person, but had a great experience. So that's another testament to it seems to be going well.
Thank you, David. Klaus.
One of the things which people were critical about was the transition from general education advising to the major. And so maybe you can elaborate on this just a little bit. At what point of time do your advisors actually make sure that students have declared a major, and what is the transition then to the more developmental advisory?
Students can declare a major still coming in on day one. And we do have them with specific pods of advisors that work with that college. So it's not all of our advisors are advising different majors or anything like that. We do specialize by college to make sure that they know the curriculum. We are doing the transition after 60 hours. When the student has 60 earned hours, we are transitioning back to the colleges. Some of the colleges, if they have pre-curriculum, they've asked, we wait until the student has met all the requirements to be officially admitted, and then we will transition them. As we move forward, I met with IT earlier this week. We are creating, or they created, a system for us to be able to upload personalized individual four-year plans for every student that'll be accessible in TopNet. So the advisor can upload it, and then the student will have view rights on their side. We'll be able to do that with also a career plan, and we're putting in learning contracts for some of our summer scholars. And all of that will be viewable for any advisor, so the faculty member will be able to see, okay, this is what we've said you need to do. and be able to just pick it up right then without having any paper files moving around campus or anything else. So we're trying to make it as seamless as possible. We do have some other additions that have happened. So Ogden isn't here, but they are starting to utilize faculty mentors, where students are meeting with both their academic advisor and a faculty mentor, and it's their hope that that faculty member will end up becoming their academic advisor those last 2 years. So we're trying to make it so it doesn't seem like there's this halfway through their career a jolting change, but we just smoothly transition them.
Okay. Well, what do you do with people who come in undeclared?
We have advisors that work with undeclared. There is a policy on the books that a student does need to declare a major by 60 hours. So we work with them. We are also doing work with the career coaches, so we have different plans they can do, different assessments to see what their skills are, to try to work with them to find out what their interests are. We definitely use Colonnade as a way to explore majors and try to help a student get to where they're going, but it's still on the books right now that a student does have to declare a major prior to the start of their 60th credit hour.
Thank you.
Does anyone have any more questions for Chris? Well, Chris, thank you. And this is a little bit late, and I can't believe I didn't see this on Facebook. But in July of 2018, you were named Assistant VP of Student Success. And like I said, I can't believe I didn't see it on Facebook, but I want to congratulate you now. And
it's
quite a compliment to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Bell?
Very good.
Chairman Bell, that's the end of my report.
Okay. Thank you. I'd like to go to the executive committee. We have one information item. We have Donald and Brad here to give us an update on property that we've heard about before.
Thank you, Chairman Bale. And Mr. Younglove will pull up a quick presentation here in a second so you can get an idea of the property that we're talking about. Just to give you an update of where we stand with the College Heights Foundation, if you'll remember back at your April meeting of last year, we had come to the Board of Regents to undertake an agreement with the College Heights Foundation where we were going to renovate the existing building. And that's the existing building that sits next to Weatherby Administration Building between there and the Chandler Chapel. We first looked at a renovation of this building after we received a generous gift from Mr. Cliff Todd. That renovation ended up being too costly. It was anticipated to be a $1.6 million renovation. The bids came back in at $2.1 million. So we received word at that time that it was going to be cheaper to raise that building and build a new one. So we worked with the Campus Master Plan Committee for planning, design, and construction, and all the parties involved went through the design process of designing a new building for that site. Those bids came back in November, which is, again, supposed to be about a $2 million project, came back in at $3.8 million because of that site. Extremely challenging. We had six contractors that showed up at the pre-bid meeting. Four ended up bidding on the project. The low bid was 3.8. The high was 4.6. And as you know, the mission of the College Heights Foundation is on scholarships, not on building and construction. So our board felt like that was not something that we were going to be able to do or chose to undertake from a fiduciary standpoint at the time. So at the College Heights Foundation board meeting at the end of the year, we decided to go a different direction. We were able to acquire a property at 1703 Chestnut Street, which was the home of John and Susan Minton. That home was appraised at $1.3 million. The Mintons provided a $400,000 bargain sale, gift in kind of that, so we acquired it for $950,000. It's a 6,300 square foot facility, and that's the recommendation for the College Heights Foundation to proceed there. The previous arrangement that we had is the university provided the building for the College Heights Foundation, so that's the arrangement that we would look at this point as we would deed this property back over to the university. And then that would serve as the home. And I'm going to turn it over to Brad Harrison and give you an idea of the property and where the university already owns existing property.
Right now, presently, the property that's being discussed here at 1703 Chestnut Street is this property here. It's approximately 3.14 acres. We presently, the university, this is currently in the university's campus master plan. And we currently own this property, these two houses, and this is 513 Regents. The president's house is located here. And this property that's under discussion is this all the way back to this fence row back in here, and then back around to Chestnut Street. The roundabout's down here. This is Regents. This is Normal. We own this property at the corner, 501 Regents, 503, 513 here. This is our Chestnut Street parking lot.
And then all of the property that, that Brad just mentioned, there's a fence line that separates 1703 from those ones on Regent, so it is adjacent property to what the university already owns. The Carwell property where the parking lot is next to the president's home was acquired in a trust a number of years ago, and there's a home there that houses our environmental health and safety. And I thought you might appreciate this. This area, this 3.2 acres, used to be called Bird Lawn, and it was an 1898 historic structure. If you can see the picture on the right, the campus Acropolis up in the background. So, the whole southern end of the campus where Barnes Campbell, Bemis Lawrence, the Preston Center, that whole area was part of the original farm that went with this house in 1898. So the university had acquired pieces through the years. Most recently, this was a 5-acre piece. They separated off 2 1-acre lots on Normal Drive and then kept the 3 acres that faces over on the Chestnut Street side. So there are the specifics on Chestnut Street, 6,300 square feet, approximately 3.14 acres. It was built in 1898, completely remodeled in 1992, taken back to the studs at that point in time. It's appraised for $1.35 million. The College Heights Foundation Board just met yesterday afternoon to approve the transaction, so we'll be working with Deborah Wilkins, Brian Russell, and Brad and President Caboni to iron out the details in the next week or two. But that we would ask at your next meeting that to accept the deed for this property from the College Heights Foundation. The College Heights Foundation would subsequently lease it back from the university going forward. And then we're anticipating May of 2019 relocation. There are a few things that we'll need to do in the residence just to get it up to speed from an office standpoint. We'll have to pull fiber over from the existing sustainability center and the doctoral house on that corner. Some electrical work that'll need to be done, and then the stone columns out front will include signage for the new Cliff Todd Center. So all this was done at about a quarter of the price of what we were going to look at from the new construction up at the top part of the hill, keeping our focus on scholarships and all private support, no university funds required for this.
How much is coming back? $400.
Say that again.
On the purchase price, how much was going to be?
So the purchase price ended up being $950,000. It was $1.35 is what it was appraised for, so the Mintons provided a $400,000 gift in kind. They felt like it was important for the university to maintain and own this again, historic structure. Chuck Clark invited me to go to the Landmark Association meeting a few weeks back to talk about this, and we are committed to preserving that structure.
Is it wheelchair accessible as well as all the other requirements?
That's one of the things that we'll do before we take occupancy. There are two steps on the front porch, so we'll build a ramp to make it accessible up to the front porch. Once you get into the entry level, then we'll have offices and the main spaces and restrooms and everything that would be accessible. Plan now is not to install an elevator into the other two floors because we can provide everything that we need from an accessibility standpoint on that first floor.
And how much do you estimate those renovations to be?
We're getting those estimates right now, but I'd say 100 to 150 by the time we add the ramp, do the electrical, do the stonework signage out front. There are a few cosmetic changes on the inside, so we'll have a little more than $1 million in it.
I've heard Mike Henson tell me when we renovated a house, it was going to be 100, 150. That's why our houses all have nicknames, Pam and Tammy and so things like that. But you are aware that it could be when you get into a structure that's 100 years old, over 100 years old, that it could be much more costly than that.
We are. Again, the good thing, in 1992, the Minton family took it all the way back to the stud, so it was completely redone in 92. So all the old knob and tube wiring and electrical and plumbing, everything was redone. So it's really a 26-year-old structure inside the 100-year-old bones. We will monitor that, and again, all that has been raised through private support from the GIF, so our focus is on not asking for any more private support to make this happen, and this was a quarter of the price of what new construction was.
This may be late in the game to be asking this question, but was there space on campus that could have been utilized? And when I looked at, and I've been reading the strategic plan and looked at the white paper and different things like that, there was a talk about having a big foundation that kind of looked at that Falls College Heights and then WKU Foundation kind of fell under. And they're talking about combining resources. Well, does this mean that at some point in time, of course, I'm asking from two hats, because I have a hat on as WKU Foundation, also as a Board of Regents, and as does Dr. Bale to some degree, because he is the chair and he sits on the foundation board. Does this mean that at some point in time, the foundation employees will move over to this building? And if that's the case, what happens to that building that they own? Because the Alumni Association, there were some issues with that, and now the foundation owns that building. Is there a possibility that you would move them out of the Alumni Association?
I think at this point, all those discussions are still happening from a foundation level of what that looks like and how do we create efficiencies and more effective for the institution as a whole. This 3.2 acres could create an opportunity to create a space over there for everybody to be together. As far as opportunities looked at on campus, this project has been going on for maybe a year and a half to 2 years now, and Mr. Cliff Todd, who provided the gift, it was very important to him to have a building that was going to be the home of the College Heights Foundation or any future foundations in the future. So we looked at first the renovation. Again, that was too costly. Looked at building the new building at that point, which is going to be too costly. So his entire gift is what was utilized to purchase this to create the Cliff Todd Center. But to specifically answer the question, I think those discussions are still happening between the foundations, and this could provide opportunity for growth there at that point. If the foundations decide to go somewhere else at that point, this will still be the Cliff Todd Center that could be used for something else university-wide.
Well, what would happen to the Alumni Association, the Alumni Center? I mean, there's dead space there right now. You go in that place, it's like a morgue. There's a lot of underutilized space. I believe there's a suite upstairs. If you reconfigured it, there would be a suite of four offices. I just was curious as if you're talking about having all this fall under an umbrella, would it make sense if we were already together? Now you're talking about, and right now, too, for those of y'all who don't know, the foundation does help support the Alumni Center. So what will happen to that building if you were to pull them out? And then even if, when I read your strategic plan white paper, it looks like you want to include the Alumni Association. So what would end up happening to the Alumni Center?
Well, as far as the strategic plan white paper, it wouldn't change the impact of the Alumni Association and where that reports. I think the overall umbrella is to look at everything and how we work together. You've got the Ogden Foundation, the Student Life Foundation, the Alumni Association, the WKU Foundation, the Hilltopper Athletic Foundation. How do all those entities work together to best serve the institution in their respective lanes? The College Heights Foundation mission has been on scholarships. The Real Estate Corporation has been on acquiring properties. The WKU Foundation has been on professorships and capital projects. HAF from an athletic standpoint. So I think all of those discussions are still happening of how we work together. What Regent Henson is referencing in the Alumni Association, part of that has been an impact of the budget cuts. There have been 9 employees that have been lost in the Division of Philanthropy and Alumni Engagement. When we first moved into the Alumni Center, there was very limited opportunity for growth at that point. The College Heights Foundation actually looked at moving down there at that point, and then there was not funding available at the time to be able to create that extra suite. Mr. Todd came on after that point in time to provide that gift. John Paul Blair can probably speak more than I can about the occupants of that building now, but it's been 9 employees. There's probably those 9 empty spots that are now available, but the hope would be for philanthropy and alumni engagement that would continue to escalate. The alumni base grows by 3,000 to 3,500 every year. We've now added, over the course of about the past 10 years since we had any staff growth, more than 30,000 alumni to the base. So ideally, there would be more growth in philanthropy and alumni engagement that would come back into that space too, which wouldn't impact the roles of the foundation.
I know whenever I walk up there, when I attend a foundation board meetings there, it's very quiet, it's very underutilized space and a lot of what I call dead space. And it doesn't look like that property is utilized like it could be. I know that I think it was supposed to be a thriving center, and by putting College Heights in that building, it seems like it would have created more travel or more walkthrough, that kind of thing. It just seemed like it might work better if it was done that way. But it sounds like this house is already a done deal.
Well,
We did have three or four options on the table, and President Caboni and I had a conversation about that, and one of the conversations that we talked about was, does that make sense? But ultimately, for Mr. Todd's gift to be used for his intended purpose, and then the future growth for Blanton Alumni Engagement, that did not make sense at this point. So this house has been purchased by the College Heights Foundation, and what we would ask the regents to look at is a similar arrangement that we had in the previous one, is we would deed it over to Western Kentucky University. And there are lots of details to be worked out in that, so Deborah Wilkins and Brian Russell and Brad Wheeler and President Caboni and I will meet in the next couple of weeks to iron those out, to bring you all what those agreements look like prior to that March meeting.
I think Regent Henson, that makes a really good point. I should be asking the chair. I'm sorry. And one of, as an institution, we have to be more intentional about our space utilization. I think our budget model moves us toward that. We're going to have a master plan done in the next 6 to 9 months that also looks at space utilization. And the question that we have is, do you need more space, or do you need to use the space you have more efficiently? And that has implications for, you know, capital projects, but also has implications for what buildings stay up, which if are there others that would come down. And I have questions about how we're using lots of places on campus. One, the quietness of the Alumni Center is one. There are other places on campus that you go into and they are either remarkably vibrant for the first 3 hours of the day and then there's no one there. And we have other parts of campus and extended campus that also are underutilized. So I think a master plan that looks both at space utilization and what we have, and then also maps out 20 years. Like, you know, what year is that, 20 years from now? Looking toward 2040, right? What's the utilization of space then? What does technology do to it? What facilities do we truly need versus ones that we just want? And we have to have, I think, some pointed conversations around that and prioritization.
Because there is a lot of dead space in the Alumni Center. A lot.
Another example would be, I think our College Heights Foundation is actually in there right now in the Honors College and International Building. I was really pleased with the decision to move languages in there, an academic department where you have more foot traffic, and the decision to move international offices from the second floor down to the ground floor, again, to create that buzz, foot traffic, and utilization. We need to make sure that particularly our prime locations on campus that are our newest facilities can't sit fallow because we haven't programmed them the right way. So I concur.
And it also makes sense to have the foundations in that one building, say, because when I first gave my pledge to the Alumni Center when I was on the Alumni Association, I wanted to give a scholarship. But I was able to talk to both Donald and Ron Wilson at the time because it was together. So there's people when people donate or want to give, there may be an opportunity if they were combined. And so it makes sense to me to utilize that space. And so I think especially after we look at the ramp model and we start how that's all set up and how you utilize space that way, it makes more sense to probably look at it as being combined. And I understand that Mr. Todd gave the gift. Sometimes a gift isn't really a gift when it ends up costing you a lot more.
And that was the part of the rationale in the College Heights decision, is it did not make sense to go back into the existing spot and spend three times what this other one would.
Which totally makes sense.
And I think the other thing to factor in part of that thinking that you're mentioning is the Office of Philanthropy, which is all in Weatherby Administration Building, which had to convert two closets in the offices. So there may be some opportunities between what philanthropy and alumni are doing, back to your point about interaction with the public.
Because that would give more foot traffic. And, you know, and then the Alumni Center is not open on the weekends. I mean, a lot of your alumni come through town. So it might offer some further advantages to that as well.
Good points.
No.
Great points. So what will the current building in what's for?
So that'll be a university decision on what to do with that building. It's got a pretty significant deferred maintenance price tag on it right now. So the President Caboni, I think, will ultimately decide what's going to happen with that.
We have demolition days.
So our master plan will help decide what occurs with that building. You know that there are some buildings that we're trying to hold vacant that are at the end of their useful lives, being for us to renovate them use them as they exist now would cost more money than taking them down and replacing it. At the same time, you see a project like the WKU Commons, where you have a historic property or historic building that you want to maintain, you just have to rethink. So there are some buildings that were built to last for 30 or 50 years and come down. There are others that were built to last 100 or 150 and be renovated. We just have to be smart about which ones we keep and which ones we replace.
And to that point,
and I don't have a hard hat or an axe or whatever, a sledgehammer.
And when we started talking about that, Brian Russell kind of weighed in that that was probably built as a 50-year building. It was $237,000 to build in 1969, as you can tell from those pictures. That's been touched much since then. Chairman Bale, the board had approved back at the April meeting the current arrangement up there. So what we're asking is that over the next few weeks we kind of outline what this new arrangement would be to bring back the board based on that shift in location. The arrangement will essentially be the same and just be a shift in where it belongs.
Any other questions or comments from anyone? Okay, well, thank you for your presentation. And
thank you.
We'll watch carefully how that unfolds.
Thank you, Brad.
It's hard to believe that it was 3 years ago this meeting, I think, when Gary Ransom announced that he was going to retire, and then he went into a search process, and 2 years ago this meeting, I think, it was announced that he was going to take over the reins, and he worked feverishly even before he officially, July 1st of that year. Everyone has before them a list of the accomplishments of the last 18 to 20 months, and I think it's nice for all of us just to take a deep breath and reflect on that for a second. Major accomplishments in this last academic year, many of which we heard about today and will continue to hear about. So, a lot of strategy involved in the budget, in our CAPE project, and really it's a major overhaul that has been in the process now and will continue to be for a long time. But take this moment to reflect on all that and thank Dr. Cavoni for his extraordinary leadership since he. Even before he arrived officially on campus. Read about it.
I did not realize that it was 2 years, but now that you say it, boy, time flies when you're having fun, I guess. What I want to say is that when the board hired me, they asked me, you weren't hiring a president, you were hiring someone to build a presidency. And so none of this happens just because of me. None of it happens just because of me and Casey's work. It happens because of the amazing team of people that we have and continue to build both around me and across the campus and the work of the whole community. So while I'm appreciative of the individual recognition, the real kudos go to the entire university that have really done remarkable work in the past.
And it is more than appropriate to recognize Casey, who's with us this morning, too, for her efforts. It's a 24/7 job for both of you living under that roof, and we're glad you have been and continue to be all in, so to speak. So, with no other business before us, I'm
glad to be able to mention something.
Sure.
A year ago, we had Todd brought in three scholar athletes. From the Lady Topper volleyball team. And one of them was a young woman by the name of Alyssa Kavanaugh. And Alyssa has been fighting a battle. I don't know if you all remember, they were quite impressed. Those three young ladies were quite impressive when they came in here. Two of them, I think, if I remember correctly, were going to go to graduate school here at WKU, but Alyssa was going to go to Europe, if I remember this. And where I'm going with this is that a couple of months ago, I started seeing the Courier-Journal. We get the Courier-Journal, I was reading it, and I followed along with this young woman. And at some point in time, I think maybe the second story, I realized that she was one of the young women that was here and came and spoke with us. And she has gotten a rare form of cancer. And there have been really three big stories about what's going on with her. She's right now, I believe, the chemo has, she's in remission, but now she's going to get a bone marrow. And Todd, you need to step up here because Travis has done a phenomenal job getting the word out about bone marrow donors and things like that. Would you like to add anything? I just kind of wanted to bring up about this young woman that was here about a year ago with us.
I'd be glad to. Appreciate you bringing that up. You know, through adversity, sometimes good things happen. There's really been two things, I think, that have come out of this that have been very positive. Number one, what you alluded to, is the support of the community in a way, not just the Bowling Green community, the Western Kentucky community has rallied around Alyssa's situation, which they have. But I think the entire volleyball community nationwide, I mean, schools that we haven't even played, athletes that she didn't even know, have kind of joined the crusade to get the word out and try to find a donor for her. So that's the number one. I think just Americans coming together, people they don't even know, you know, has been very inspiring. And the other thing I think that's come out of this that has personally, you know, meant so much to me is honestly the way Alyssa has handled it from a personal standpoint. If you talk to her, if you're around her, you would have no idea that she has ever been ill, and that she's facing the challenge that she's facing. Her attitude, her optimism, her perseverance, the way she's just handled every aspect of this has been inspiring, I think, to everybody who knows her. And now, and recently, we have some good news. It's interesting, through all the attempts to find a donor and everything that goes into all that, as you mentioned, she is in remission now through the chemotherapy, and they have found a donor for her for the bone marrow. And for those of you who don't know, it's actually her father. And that's a long story there in and of itself, but it's actually, there's 10 components, I guess, that are involved in trying to find a match in her father. And finding 10 out of 10 is almost unheard of. But her father actually is a match in 8 of the 10. So the doctors feel really good about the possibility that she is actually in Cincinnati right now as we speak. We'll be undergoing that very soon. And that's a lengthy process. It's multiple months that she'll actually be there through all this, that you have the bone marrow transplant and then intensive monitoring of everything. But she was here last week on campus, and as she has been all along, incredibly optimistic through everything. And I think we're all hoping and praying for the best, but there does appear to be much more hope now than certainly there was months ago.
That's good to hear. And also, Travis, I think, even said that if whoever matched her bone marrow, that he would pay their tuition for WKU. So Travis was really trying to grow the donor list as well as any student that matched, that he was willing to pay the tuition. I think that says a lot about a coach that would step up and do that.
No, it does. Maybe her dad will come back and get a master's degree.
Thank you, Todd. Thank you, God.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, good to bring that up. With no other business, we can disperse. I think we have lunch.
We do.